From the Los Angeles Times, this is The Envelope, the podcast, your ultimate guide to award season. I'm one of your hosts, Mark Olson.
And I'm your other host, Yvonne Villarreal. Every week, our podcast showcases key voices across both TV and film.
How are you doing today, Yvonne? I have to tell you, I really enjoyed the profile you wrote this weekend about Mary Steenburgen.
Aw, thank you. I'm doing well. Like, that was nice to have out. Like, I interviewed her back in January. You know, some things take their course, and that's finally out. We've had an earthquake that I wasn't awake for. The SAG Awards happened over the weekend. What did you think of the winners that came out of that?
It was predictable in some categories, not predictable in some others. I think for like on the movie side, the fact that the best actress race in particular seems like it's really up in the air. And then also between Viola Davis, Carey Mulligan, Frances McDormand, I feel like any of them could win at this point. And then also with the best ensemble prize going to The Trial of the Chicago 7, which on the one hand, that is a movie with a big ensemble cast, so it makes sense that it wins this SAG award. It's a movie that felt like its sort of best picture momentum had been fading a little bit, but in so many ways, that's like a full boat, like proper Oscar movie in the like old-fashioned sense of the idea, that suddenly it's like, oh, now we got a race again. Like, who knows what's going to happen?
It just feels weird to still be thinking about the Oscars in April. So I'm just like, I'm ready to get to the show already. I don't know about you.
But then I keep getting confused because on the TV side, like, I admit I don't really understand the TV awards calendar. And so, like, especially to have Schitt's Creek, like, still winning stuff, what seems like from two award cycles and one pandemic ago is just very confusing.
Time is a flat circle. Yeah, it's weird.
But now who were you talking to this week?
Yes, it's my turn, finally. I spoke with Kate Mara. You know, she plays a high school teacher who abuses her power in the FX on Hulu series, A Teacher. And for those who aren't familiar in it, she plays Claire, who gets involved with her teenage student, Eric. And the series really sort of explores the consequences of their relationship. And it's sort of an expansion of the 2013 movie of the same name from series creator Hannah Fidel. And Kate told me, you know, she really enjoyed this role.
That's the reason why I love movies and TV. And, you know, it's the reason I love being an actor so much is you're exposing different people's stories and you're opening up these conversations that maybe wouldn't be had otherwise.
You know, what I like so much about the expansion of this idea with the TV show is how you really come to understand all the decisions, every bad decision that this woman is making, Kate's character, but yet the show's not really asking you to like sympathize with her. It's not turning into some sort of like anti-heroine. Like, she is making bad decisions. You understand why she does it, and yet she's still doing it. It's like, it's a really interesting way to approach a character.
Well, even seeing how the student Eric has processed what has happened as time goes on and really seeing, wait, this was an abuse of power and she inflicted pain on me. It's really interesting to see how it all sort of shakes up as you get to the end of it.
Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation and we'll get to that in just a couple of minutes.
Hi, this is Harry Litman, LA Times legal columnist and host of the Talking Feds podcast, a roundtable discussion that brings together prominent former government officials, journalists, and special guests. This year, we're covering everything you need to know about the presidential transition with guests that include Valerie Jarrett, Senator Amy Klobuchar, and Congressman Jamie Raskin. So tune in everywhere that you find podcasts.
Yvonne's conversation with Kate Mara about A Teacher is up next. But first, let's pass the mic over to our awards columnist, Glenn Whipp, for his awards minute.
The Oscars are a couple of weeks away, and we're finally starting to get some hints about what this year's ceremony might look like. Short answer, it's going to be different. And not different in a sad kind of Zoom virtual kind of way, though, like what we saw at the Golden Globes. One of the show's producers is Steven Soderbergh, and you probably know him from all kinds of movies. And he's saying he's making this show look like a film. Interesting. I don't know what that means, but one thing that's going to be different is that it's not going to be at the cavernous Dolby Auditorium. It's going to be at Union Station, which is this historic place downtown LA, Art Deco, classic Spanish colonial building, really cool. I'm sorry if that's going to disrupt transportation. They seem to be sorry too. They're promising it won't, but who knows? Anyway, Soderbergh is promising that the first 60 seconds of the show will make your knees buckle. And that's a quote, will make your knees buckle. What could that mean? I have never experienced a knee buckling moment watching an award show. So what could that be? Is it a cast reunion of Ocean's 11 with Brad, Julia, and George Clooney? Maybe he's bringing out the cast of Magic Mike and they're going to do a dance number to open the show. That would be different. But the thing is, I'm curious, and I have not been curious approaching an Oscar ceremony in a really long time. So I'm hoping Soderbergh kind of keeps those hints coming, keeps dropping that little trail of breadcrumbs as we get closer to the show. I don't know. I'm optimistic. It's going to be different, and it could be different in a good way.
Thanks, Glenn. And of course, our colleague Carolina Miranda also wrote a story about the Oscars telecast and how perhaps instead of using Union Station as their sort of hub, they could have used the Music Center. It would have provided a lot of the same facilities and uses that they need. It wouldn't have caused the disruption to commuters. And also it would show some connection to the sort of the theater and performing arts community in Los Angeles as well.
I think I'm still hung up on Steven Soderbergh and this quote about making our knees buckle with this telecast. And I'm trying to think, like, what can make my knees buckle in 2021? And one, it's either Dr. Anthony Fauci finally declaring that this pandemic is over. That would make my knees buckle. Or if, like, we suddenly get an announcement that Reggae Jean Page is back on Bridgerton. Like, I'm trying to think, like, what would make my knees buckle? Mark, what would make your knees buckle?
Yeah, it's hard to think what in the frame of award season is going to make your knees buckle in 2021. But this is why Steven Soderbergh is producing the Oscars and I am not.
Yeah.
We'll see.
It's going to be a mind trip for sure. Yeah.
And so now here's Yvonne talking to Kate Mara.
Well, Kate, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So people who know your work, you know that you've played unlikable or morally questionable characters before, perhaps most notably in Netflix's House of Cards. But Claire in A Teacher is those things in such a different kind of way than we've seen you play before. What made her a character you wanted to spend time figuring out?
Well, I think it's exactly what you said. It's a character that I haven't played before, which is something that I genuinely, search for. There's many reasons why I haven't worked much in the last year and a half, COVID being one of them. But also really, truly, it's because I do yearn to find characters that are challenging and different than ones that I've either played before or ones that I, typically get offered. And Claire Wilson in A Teacher was definitely one that I hadn't explored before. So I was excited for that reason.
Did it sort of make it easier to sort of disappear into her? And was that almost alarming how easy that might have been?
I found it easy to, well, I don't know if I would say I found it easy, but I, in general, I do switch on and off relatively easily. I mean, when we were shooting A Teacher, I had a newborn with me, so I had no choice but to be able to sort of like walk onto set, turn into this person. And then as soon as I get back into my trailer, it's not like on other jobs before I had my daughter. It's not like I could just go into my trailer and sort of stay in that mindset. I had to switch off and go into mom mode. I think I got pretty good at learning how to compartmentalize things, specifically emotions, which was helpful with my character because Claire, one of the things that she does so well in her life is compartmentalize things, you know, and she's able to sort of disappear into this other world when she's having this super inappropriate relationship with her student. Yeah, it was an interesting thing to explore.
Mm. Well, you know, through the years, you know, we've obviously heard about many cases like this in the news. I mean, I know I vividly remember like the tabloid storm that sort of surrounded Mary Kay Letourneau. And I was in grade school at that point. Did you research these types of relationships before you started shooting? Or did you sort of not want to get too into the psychology of what Claire was doing?
Oh, yeah, I researched as much as you could. It's not like I had someone to call up and ask why they had personally been in this situation before. You know, I wasn't playing someone, although she was based on many different people, you know, she wasn't a real person. So I definitely had to do a lot of research. And Anna Fidel and I were constantly sending each other news articles on a weekly basis, because that was the most helpful thing, was to really explore where these women come from, what their backgrounds are like. You know, the Mary Kay Letourneau story, there had been a few documentaries made about her. And so I absolutely watched those. And yeah, you just sort of take little bits from different stories. That's what I did for Claire, to sort of come up with who she was outside of the scripts that were available to me.
Mm-hmm. And for our listeners who may not know, Hannah Fidel created the series that Kate's in, and it's an extension of her 2013 feature film that is also called The Teacher.
Yeah, Hannah made a film called The Teacher. It is the same sort of story as our series, but different in many ways. And, you know, our series focuses a lot on the aftermath and of, you know, the consequences of what happens when this teacher chooses these things. And the movie focuses mostly on the actual relationship in that time, whereas our show, you know, jumps forward and really explores consequences.
Was that part of what intrigued you about what Hannah was trying to achieve here? Because, you know, in the wake of the Me Too movement and sort of the conversations that it sparked, we've seen, you know, on-screen depictions of sexual abuse, you know, and they've become more nuanced. You know, I'm thinking about shows like I May Destroy You or Unbelievable, because traditionally these sorts of teacher-student relationships are sort of portrayed as romantic or illicit. We don't really see it in the kind of way that we see it depicted in a teacher. You know, I'm thinking about like 90210 and Dawson's Creek. Was seeing the sort of aftermath something that really struck you about what Hannah was doing here?
Yeah, because like you said, we could name a bunch of shows that dealt with the actual relationship, that, you know, maybe an episode here or there that dealt with the actual relationship of it. And obviously that part of the story is important. But to Hannah, which is why I sort of jumped at the opportunity to be a part of it, was she really wanted to make sure we were telling a story that hadn't been told before. And she realized and recognized that the aftermath and focusing on the consequences of the choices that you make, that sort of thing hadn't really been explored as often. And yeah, so that was a really important part of it for me that really drew me to it.
Well, I know Hannah has said in interviews that she found narrative inspiration in films like Lolita or The Piano Teacher and Funny Games. Did you turn to any of those to sort of study the performances or take something away from what she was getting inspiration from? Or did you turn to any other types of films or performances?
So I had seen, and obviously very different character, very different stories and things like that. But like I had seen Notes on a Scandal so many times. You know, I think there's so many aspects of, you know, Cate Blanchett's performance and Judi Dench's performance. There's so many things in that I was really inspired by years ago. And so that's something that I definitely rewatched, but mostly I focused on reading. I read a bunch of stories that sort of had similar subject matters. I mean, there's a book called Tampa that is not at all like our show, but it is about a teacher-student relationship. It's a dark, 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 I would say, almost comedy about it, where obviously our show is not. But yeah, I just kind of wanted to like surround myself with different art, whether it's books or news articles or films, where I did get to see, you know, different versions of this type of relationship play out and see the consequences from those places.
Mm-hmm. How much conversation did you have with Hannah about her own experience with sexual assault? Like, did that help inform you learning what it was like for her as a survivor?
Yeah, I mean, she's very open about her experience and being a survivor. And you know, she's become a good friend of mine. So we've definitely discussed those things. And, you know, one of the main reasons why she wanted to make this show, you know, and to really focus not just on Claire, but on Eric's side of this story, to see it from a survivor's point of view, especially in the second half of the series and the consequences of this relationship and how it really affects the survivor. And her personal story definitely affected the way this one was told. And not just Hannah, but a lot of other people that I spoke to who have either had, you know, similar situation and or are just, you know, survivors in different ways, or that have friends that are. I mean, I found it really interesting that, you know, the second you open up the conversation, really, it doesn't matter who you're talking to. Everybody knows somebody or has been affected by it in some way. So, yeah, I just think it's closer to home than people really are aware of.
The show does such an interesting job of giving us details about Claire's life. You know, we obviously see that she's in a somewhat unsatisfying marriage. You know, she has the trauma of her mother's death and her father's alcoholism. And, you know, we hear her talk about somewhat about her like wasted youth, like not really partaking in the way other people do. What did those details do for you in shaping her, or even just understanding how those things, which those are things a lot of us deal with and a lot of us don't make the bad decisions that she makes. How did those details help you understand why she did make the bad decisions that she made?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, like playing a character like this, because I don't necessarily think that I personally have to, in order to play a character like this, that I, at the end of the day, have to understand why she did it. I think that creating her and making sure that we're portraying this person as real and rounded and, you know, layered like all human beings are, and not just good or bad, you know, I think that was more important. And that really came out of just lots of conversations with Hannah and with our writer's room in trying to create a character that people hopefully don't just look at and think like, well, she's not relatable because I don't agree with, you know, the choice that she made. The hope was that we created somebody that you could relate to in some way, whether it's before she, you know, is in this relationship with her student or after the fact when you learn more about her upbringing or whatever. I mean, it doesn't mean that everybody with a, you know, difficult childhood or background makes bad choices. That's 100% not accurate, but a lot of people also do. And I think that it's just, it's an interesting character study, you know, to sort of like figure out, well, why did she possibly end up where she did? And can we not forgive? Because it's not up to anybody to forgive this person except for, you know, it's nobody's choice to sort of say you're forgiven, I think, unless we're talking about the person that she actually did the harm to. So I think that's entirely up to the survivor's discretion. But, you know, it was definitely important to us to really try and come up with a storyline, a backstory that people could connect with and or hear and go, oh, I actually look at her a little bit differently now than I did at the beginning, you know?
Mm-hmm. To sort of build off that, I mean, in the wake of the Me Too movement, there have been these discussions about rehabilitation and what is the correct future for abusers? Like, who does determine like when someone can move on with their life? Like, how did this story of Claire challenge your ideas of that? Can there be degrees of evil? Like, is she at a different point in the spectrum than someone like a Harvey Weinstein? And like, who gets to decide that?
Well, that's such a good point. And it's one of the reasons why we wanted to make the show, is because like, not everybody is in a position in their lives or goes through something in their lives where they're forced to actually think about this type of thing. That's the reason why I love movies and TV. And, you know, it's the reason I love being an actor so much, is you're exposing different people's stories and you're opening up these conversations that maybe wouldn't be had otherwise in certain households. And, you know, I certainly wasn't thinking about this type of thing and this type of question before diving into this series. It's so important to be able to put things out there that people are uncomfortable with thinking about, talking about, because otherwise, you know, how does anything change? And how does, I do think it's an important discussion to have. I don't have the answer, but I definitely think that it's how I think we all grow and learn and have empathy for different types of people, you know?
Yeah, I guess the question too is, should we be having empathy for predators like this?
Oh, well, I actually, when I said empathy, I don't just mean predator. I mean empathy also for the survivor. Some people don't know, God willing, haven't experienced such trauma, or don't have close friends that have. And I just think it's so important to open our minds to both sides of the story. You know, it's not just having empathy for, and like you said, I understand why some people close their sort of mind to that, having empathy for, you know, the person who's in the power position. But I do think it's important to sort of open that conversation up to both people, to both the predator and the survivor, you know, having empathy for all different types of people, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the series, I think this is the first time that you have worked with an intimacy coordinator. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. How did you find that experience?
I think that the idea of an intimacy coordinator is fantastic. And I think that I personally haven't had roles or scenes, I guess I would say, where I felt that I needed it, you know, in my past before I knew there was such a role or option to have one. I, you know, luckily, I would say, have not been in the position where I felt sort of unsafe or uncomfortable with a scene, usually because any scene that I've had to do something sort of intimate or physically vulnerable, I've always had a director. I'm pretty sure I've been acting for a long time, but I'm trying to think back. I think I've always had a director who I just really trusted and felt like I could, you know, speak up if I was uncomfortable with something. On this, it was a very interesting experience. You know, a lot of it was just talking about the scenes and making sure everybody knew exactly what was going on. We decided as a team, you know, me and Hannah and Ashley, who plays my husband, and Nick, who plays Eric, the student. We all, after meeting with the intimacy coordinator and really delving into all of the scenes, and we decided that we didn't need them to be on set with us. I really rely on my director. And Hannah, every scene that she wrote, anything intimate that I had to do, she always talked to me about it, either after the fact or before she even wrote it. So I just felt so safe and protected that I didn't want another voice sort of in my head about, you know, what to do or how to do it. As long as like the people that I had the scenes with were comfortable as well, I felt like we were good to sort of do it on our own. And we were, and it really did feel like a very safe environment for all of us. But I think the idea of an intimacy coordinator at this point is very, very smart. And I think that everyone should have the option if they would like it, you know?
Our nation has endured. Let's make sure the facts do, too. Pay $1 for 8 weeks and get a perspective unlike anywhere else. Go to latimes.com/subscribe. Los Angeles Times, the state of what's next.
Hey, this is Andy Bernstein, Hall of Fame photographer for the NBA and host of the Legends of Sport podcast. For the past 3 seasons, we've spoken to icons such as Magic Johnson, Steve Kerr, Jerry West, and Sue Bird. And not just from the world of basketball, but legends of all sports, including owners, superfans, and members of the sports media. Find new episodes of Legends of Sport on the LA Times app or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
See, this is the type of podcast you gotta have.
Well, as we discussed, you know, the series is structured in a way where the early episodes deal with Claire and Eric having this relationship in secret, and the second half deals with sort of the consequences of being caught. And there's a searing scene in the finale. It's the scene, really, where Eric sort of confronts Claire about what she did to him. They meet for lunch. What did you think of that scene and the way it sort of ended there, leaving Claire, who has lived all these years convinced that it was consensual? She's left there to linger with the sort of confrontation of her actions.
What did I think of it? I loved the fact that we were all of a sudden, you know, giving Eric the position of power. Hannah was talking about that scene and why it was written the way it was and why she wanted the show to end in that way, you know. And she was saying because she, as a survivor, it was something that she never got the opportunity to do, to confront her abuser and say the things that she had been thinking. And so many survivors don't have that opportunity for whatever reason. And it was really important to her and to us that Eric finally has that moment and, you know, realization and growth and all of those things. And I just loved it. I mean, it was a really, it was such an interesting scene to shoot all day, you know, because our character's dynamic throughout the whole series was a very specific one with my character having the power, whether she admits it or not, you know, that really always was the dynamic. And then all of a sudden for it to shift and, for it all to sort of be in his court all of a sudden was a really interesting shift, you know?
Well, in the finale, we learn that Claire has settled down. It takes place 10 years later, and Claire has settled down and, you know, she has a family. Were you surprised by where we find her 10 years later? Did you, I don't know, like spend a lot of time thinking about how she got there?
Yeah, I was so excited that we were doing the 10-year jump because I do find it really interesting to explore where people are 10 years after something like this. Specifically Claire, because again, like I was saying before, I don't think we haven't seen this type of story told so far ahead in time. And it was really interesting to us to explore, like, well, you know, is she able to find love again? And is she able to find someone that can actually get past what she's done and who feels, you know, sort of like safe enough to have children with her? And what do other parents think of her? And is she able to live a relatively normal life? Is she able to get a job? All of these things are so, that's real life stuff that happens in this type of situation. And so I did find it really, really fascinating and just an interesting character study to see, like, has she come to terms with the choices that she's made, or is she still telling herself, you know, all of these lies in order to sort of survive in her own world, in her own, you know, guilt and all of those things. So for me, you know, for me as an actor, it was definitely a gift to be able to play her at that different stage in her life.
Did you take anything from, like, I don't know, is there something to glean from her even having a Tesla? Like, do you go into the nitty gritty of details like that, thinking about what that means?
Yes, we definitely, all of those things are very thought out. I mean, the Tesla thing wasn't my idea, but it was a very specific choice that she marry someone. I don't know if we ever mention that her husband is much older than her, but she marries someone much older than her who is certainly wealthy. They have a Tesla. They live in a very nice house. You know, all of those things were absolutely thought of very much in detail. And yeah, Hannah and I had a lot of conversations specifically about casting my husband. It was an interesting conversation for sure. And you know, a lot of it is just stuff that like you don't ever share. It's like why you wanted the person to be older and successful and all of these things. You know, some of it's just sort of like creative, like secrets, you know what I mean? Sort of like backstory secrets that you don't ever share. And, you know, some of that's mine, but some of it's just Hannah's and, or whoever created it, who's like, you know, that this has to be, and it's just my thing. And I just really need it to be this way. Yeah. So that was one of those things.
You're also a producer on A Teacher, and this is the first TV series you've produced. I know you've produced an independent film before. So tell me, like, what made you want to take that step with this project in particular?
Well, I got really lucky because I just produced the film that I produced with one of my best friends, Elliot Page, and Hannah and Michael Costigan, our producing partner, reached out to me and asked, well, Michael and I had made Brokeback Mountain together a very long time ago. I don't know, 15 years ago or something crazy, but, you know, hadn't really stayed in touch. And they, you know, luckily thought of me for the character. And I don't know why they thought to ask me to come on as a producer, but I do feel lucky that they did, because I was definitely in the right sort of creative headspace for that. And while I had never produced a series before, it was so early on in the process, like the pilot hadn't even been written yet. It was just the idea. And I had already seen Hannah's film, A Teacher, so, and her other films as well. So I was already a fan. And after she and I spoke, I knew we would have a good working relationship. And I just sort of jumped on board. And I'm so glad I did. I mean, it took a few years really for it to get on its feet. And, you know, now after the fact, I'm developing a bunch of shows, and I just learned as a producer, I mean, and I just learned a lot in being involved in this from the ground up. It was such an amazing experience for me.
Well, that was my follow-up. What did you learn about what goes into the making of a TV show that, like, you hadn't known before? I mean, you've been in the business, you know, since you were 14 and have been on plenty of TV shows. What did you not expect in being in that position that you were like, oh, this is what I have to think about?
I mean, everything. I didn't know anything about producing a show. I think the biggest thing that I take away from it is just like how impressive it is to get any show made. There are so many steps into selling an idea to a streamer, network, whatever. That alone is such a big deal. And then from that stage to getting the first episode written and or the whole series written, to then getting the green light to actually shoot the show. I mean, there are so many steps and so much time it takes for it to actually happen that I really am just impressed that any show gets made at this point. Whether you like it or not is a whole other sort of story, but I do just kind of tip my hat to any show that gets on the air. It really does take a lot of patience and a lot of hard work. And then I do think like maybe even a little luck here and there, because there are so many shows, so many great shows that don't find the light of day.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Brokeback Mountain earlier, and I had not known that you nearly booked a role on Lost before that came your way, Brokeback Mountain. Can you please share this experience?
Yes, this is true. I had just moved to LA. I think I was 19 years old, and I had just moved to LA. It was like my first pilot season experience, which was wild. And I auditioned for Lost many times. I don't know how many times, but you know, when it came to like the final screen test, I remember sitting in the green room or what, a waiting room with the whole cast. Usually on screen tests, there's like a couple different actors that are sort of battling for a role. And you kind of know who it is because you see the other actor and you're like, oh, that person's probably my enemy. But for this, it was like, it for whatever reason, it was just one person for each role. So it was very clear what we were all there for. And they had said they were shooting in Hawaii. And I just remember like very specific things, which were like, they kept asking me if I sunburn easily because I have such pale skin. And I kept saying, no, I really don't, which is true. I don't. I use a lot of sunscreen. I remember JJ being very concerned about me getting sunburn. And I thought, oh God, am I not going to get hired because they're scared I'm going to be burned, sunburned the whole show? Needless to say, I didn't get the part. I was so bummed, as you can imagine. But literally, I think like 2 days later, I auditioned with Ang Lee, and while it's a very small part in Brokeback Mountain, it opened so many doors for me, and, you know, obviously, it was such a just incredible film to be a part of, and, you know, I wouldn't have been able to do it. You know, that was one of those things that felt very meant to be. You know, I wasn't meant to be on that show, and
the one door closes, one door opens thing.
Yeah.
But then are you like, I'm never watching Lost, or did you watch Lost?
Oh, no, I'm the opposite of that. I like want to see. Yeah, I want to see everything. I haven't watched, what is it, 8 seasons or 10? How many seasons is it?
Yeah, there's a lot.
I only watched the first season, but I was a fan like everybody else.
Well, that's one of the questions that we're asking right now is like, what have you been watching? Because so many of us have been spending months and months at home. And, you know, we're just watching way more stuff than usual. Are there any movies or shows that you've gotten around to in this time? I know you have kids. I don't know if you're being forced to watch cartoons, but tell me what you've been watching.
I can't wait for Succession to come back on. Succession's, it's the show. I actually keep trying to get my husband. He hasn't seen it yet. And I watched the first 2 seasons. I don't know why I watched them without him, but I did. I think he was behind or something. And I was like, oh, well, I can't stop now. I just have to keep going. So I keep trying to convince him that he should start watching it so I can rewatch it all with him. But yeah, I'm really excited about that to come back. It's actually one of the reasons why Ashley Zuckerman, who's in Succession, he plays my husband in a teacher. Because me and Hannah both just thought he was so good in the first season of Succession.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we were both like, oh my God, that is the guy. And he's the only one that I read with for our show. And just immediately we knew he was the one. What else? Oh, one of my favorite movies this year is Judas and the Black Messiah. I just thought that was incredible. The performances in that movie are really special. We watch a lot of movies. Once the kids go to sleep, that's our thing. We put the kids to sleep and then we relax by watching a movie.
Well, Kate, you know, you're leaving me really disappointed because I thought you were my Bravo girl. I was expecting talk of Real Housewives of Salt Lake City.
Well, no, the one that's on right now is New Jersey.
Yes, thank you.
So yes, I'm watching that religiously. And my husband like keeps saying like, I don't watch that. And then he watches every episode. But yeah, I'm a sucker for Bravo.
It's so good.
I know.
Well, how are you feeling at this point in quarantine? Like, have you been one of those people that has gotten clarity in this time on, like, you know, as it relates to your career? Like, I know you have projects in the works now, but has it got you thinking about, okay, when this is over, this is the stuff I want to focus on? Or has there been like not a lot of time to do that?
What it's done is made me, and I do feel like I have always loved my job. Really, I do. I feel like so grateful that it's my job. I can't really believe it is. But it just has sort of reinforced that. I do really do feel so lucky that that's what I get to go and do at work. I'm antsy to get back to work. But then there's also the side of it where my husband and I were talking about this. We're so excited that it feels like there's an end in sight to this quarantine. And we can't wait. And we can't wait to get the vaccine and all these things. And then there's this other sort of anxiety aspect of it, which is like, oh God, does that mean that we are going to have less time, just like as a little cocooned family. And, you know, all of those anxieties that kind of, I think, come up, especially when you're like, we've been doing the same thing for a year now. It's just the adjustments, I think, really mess with people, having to adjust back to, now we have to adjust back to like the new normal life. It's just bizarre.
Right. I don't know if I'll have the stamina for it, to be honest, but
yeah.
Is your next thing that you're going to start production on called Jane?
Yes, it is. We're still in like in the midst of details and like deals and things like that. So I actually don't know when, but that is meant to be the next thing that I shoot really soon. So again, it's like such an important story. It's about abortion rights in the 1960s and women's rights. And so it's just a story that I feel very compelled to be a part of.
And what stuck with you about that conversation, Yvonne?
In doing my research before talking to Kate, I had never known about this Lost story, that she was nearly cast in this TV series, which for better or worse, people have a lot of opinions on. I think I like to always think about the what could have been, like what would have happened. But like the fact that she was cast in Brokeback Mountain, which I then went back to watch because like I forgot that Anna Faris was in it. I was very interested in like thinking about the what could have been. That was interesting to me.
Yeah, it's funny to think about that, is how would that have changed her career if she'd have had Lost instead? And just about every actor, I think, probably has a story similar to that.
Well, and I think we all have like had those moments in this pandemic, like thinking about choices and what's the next choice when we come out of this. Like now that we are thinking about things, like what are we going to do next? So that was fascinating to me.
And then as we wrap up, what have you been watching this week?
Okay, Mark. I have been watching The Great Pottery Throwdown. And this is a show that debuted like back in like 2015 on BBC, but you can catch it on HBO Max. I can't explain it, but like you can feel your blood pressure dropping while watching this series. It's just so calming. A lot of people compare it to, you know, the Great British Bake Off in that sense, like it just relaxes you. I love the way the contestants sort of help each other when they can. It's a very like loving environment. I like the way one of the judges, Keith, sort of cries when he's overwhelmed by the beauty of one of the figures that someone has created. Like it just is like my happy place right now. Also, The Nanny is available to stream. I've also been getting into that. What about you?
I confess, I also have watched a few episodes of The Nanny. I've really been enjoying it. I mean, I remember it from when it was on. I would spottily watch it. And I think it's interesting how it is really like from a different universe, because it's a, you know, a multi-camera show with a laugh track, that it's just this old school sitcom that if you tried to make that now, it would be some sort of bizarre parody or something, you know? And I confess, I feel like we're doing a promotion here. The way I came to watching The Nanny is it's on the HBO Max platform. It came up as a recommendation after I had watched Tina, the terrific documentary about Tina Turner that I just really enjoyed. I know that there's been some conversation and criticism about that movie, that it doesn't focus enough on her as an artist, that it does focus too much on sort of the trauma of her life and her relationship with her ex-husband, Ike Turner. But after I watched Tina, the documentary, I then went back and rewatched What's Love Got to Do with It, the fiction feature about her that, of course, has Oscar-nominated performances by Angela Bassett as Tina Turner and Lawrence Fishburne as Ike Turner. And it's funny, that much like you might say about some movies this Oscar season, there are these great performances in this maybe not great movie. But the documentary, I feel like, gives you such a fuller picture of Tina. It puts so much of the events that you see in the fiction film in her own voice. Like to hear her talk about her past, I think is really fascinating. And also to just think about the idea that she participated in this documentary as a way to wrap up her public life. She lives in Switzerland in a beautiful mansion on the lake. And she's kind of done being a public person at this point in her life. And I like the idea that, like, she took this moment to sort of talk to us, the public. But between the documentary and the musical that just is also coming out, she's retiring from public life, which somehow I find fascinating. Did you watch Tina?
Oh, I watched it. And I too felt that there was maybe a little too much time focused on the very thing she said she was sort of tired of talking about throughout like her career when it was, you know, happening. But it was just so beautiful to see like her perseverance and like what had come out of all of that trauma. And I just found like by the end, I hadn't realized how loud my TV had gotten, like, because I kept putting it louder, especially when it would get to like the musical parts. Like, and by the time it ended, I was just like, oh my God, my neighbors must be like, are you crazy? What's going on? Because it's like 11 o'clock at night. Yeah, I really enjoyed that documentary too.
Yeah, I think all the footage in that was just terrific. It was so exciting to see all that vintage footage of her just as a fantastic stage performer. I was so struck by how she referred so often to work. Like she was always like, I had to get back to work. And there was something about that, just the drive that she had, and also the way that she, you know, what we think of as this sort of glamorous facade, that she, to her, that was the grind. That really was, it was her work.
Mm-hmm. I feel that grind sometimes, and then we have Zoom and that takes my grind out a little bit. But Mark, the Oscar Award ceremony is coming up on April 25th. So we're talking film next week. Who's up next?
We'll have actor Amanda Seyfried. She was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for her role as Marion Davies in Mank. The film tackles the story of how Herman Mankiewicz came to write the initial drafts of what would become the famed Orson Welles film Citizen Kane. And Seyfried, you know, plays Marion Davies, who was the sort of girlfriend of publisher William Randolph Hearst. And so she's sort of friendly with Mankiewicz and kind of becomes wrapped up in the story of the making of the movie a little bit too. The movie was directed by David Fincher, and it was really funny to hear Amanda talk about how she became truly tongue-tied when she first met him.
I had a hard time expressing anything, like what I felt and that I agreed with him. And I wanted him to know that I wasn't just a mute, but I also wanted to listen to everything he said, because everything he said is so valuable and comes from such a real place. So I hate those first time things. I would never want to do it again. But then, and I'm sure you've talked to many people that have worked with him, and like they all probably say similar things, that once the first meeting happens, you kind of, it's very warm. You become comfortable very quickly with him because he treats you like a peer as opposed to an employee.
I'm really looking forward to hearing that one next week, Mark. Did you ask her about assuming the role as Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes in the Hulu series The Dropout? She's taking over Kate McKinnon's role.
Honestly, Yvonne, I did not have to bring it up. She is obviously very excited about that role. I think she's at a point where she's very deep into like researching the role. So she was just super excited and anxious to talk about that too. Although I have to say, I was not able to get her to preview her Elizabeth Holmes voice.
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard one to nail down so soon after landing it. So I'm sure she's perfecting it, but I can't wait for that one.
I think it's going to be a good one. The Envelope, the podcast, is hosted by me, Mark Olson, and my colleague, Yvonne Villarreal. Our executive producer is Abby Fentress-Swanson. Our audio engineer is Mike Heflin. And special thanks to Mike for making our theme song.
If you like The Envelope, the podcast, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a 5-star review on Apple.
The Envelope is created by the journalists at the LA Times. Right now, access to facts has never been more important, and the Times is in the business of reporting them. Stay connected and subscribe, because your subscription supports the production of podcasts like this one and our award-winning journalism. Visit latimes.com/supportLATimes to subscribe.
Thanks for listening, and see you next week.